Welcome to the Back Ass Words Podcast. We are the Back Ass Words Boys. My name is Kyle. I use he, they pronouns. And joining me from our still beautiful, starting to get chilly Colorado studio is Arden.
And I use he, him pronouns, and it is getting chilly.
Tonight, guys, gals, and NB pals, I am going to be telling you the story of the Enfield Poltergeist. Inspiration, the loose inspiration for Poltergeist, and the more direct inspiration for The Conjuring 2.
There we go. And I am genuinely so excited for tonight's episode because I know nothing about this topic. All I know is that the name, the Enfield Poltergeist, is, as they say, a big one.
Yeah, this is definitely a big one. A lot of people know this one. I'm excited to tell you guys the story, and I'm excited to expose the Warrens for their bullshit on this one.
Because, as you all know, we are continuing our month-long, technically month-and-a-half-long, six-part series on the Warrens, Ed and Lorraine Warren, that is.
We're in the home stretch, guys.
Two of the most prolific paranormal investigators of all time. This is another one of their cases that they are related to.
Mm-hmm.
And I say related to very specifically.
So, Arden.
Yes, Kyle.
Little simple one for you. This is a more for the we're in audio format here at the Back Ass Words podcast. So I want to help people get an image of who they're listening to on the daily here, because you guys are listening to us every day.
Right.
So what does your favorite shirt look like?
Ah, this is perfect, especially because it is the month of October, which is the month of Halloween, right?
Right.
My favorite shirt, the shirt that I wear the most and that I have loved wearing since I got it, was my shirt that has the poster of the horror film The Exorcist on it.
Yes, one of my favorites of yours.
I love my Exorcist shirt. Whenever I can wear it, I try to wear it. And I try to wear it out in public, too, because I know that it freaks some people out. And I love that about that shirt. Oh my God, my favorite shirt. And it's just
it fits you really well, and it looks like it's a really, really comfy shirt too.
Yes, I believe that I got it from Cotton On, which is a wonderful.
Love Cotton On.
I love that store.
I forgot about them. Oh my God, sponsor us, please.
And to just give you more of a clearer image, it's literally just a black shirt, and the Exorcist logo is on there. It's got the purple text. It's lovely. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Gorgeous shirt. I have one. It's just the comfiest shirt I own, and it's like a baseball tee. I love the like 3/4 length sleeves, you know?
Oh yeah.
And it's just like a Yellowstone National Park shirt. Gorgeous. You know,
I love that. What color is it?
It's like black sleeves and then gray for the body of the shirt.
Ooh, nice with that 3/4 sleeve. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. I love that.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Like, if I was going to be a cartoon character, you know, that would definitely be the shirt I was wearing.
Sure. That's wonderful.
So, obviously, you guys, we are not scholars.
Nope. The best icebreaker we could come up with was a second grade get to know you day school question.
Hey, we haven't gotten to what shirt are you wearing? We're doing okay. Cute.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we are probably going to get some things wrong.
Like, how to execute that bit. All I did was come for Kyle. And honestly, I'm so sorry.
We are also not linguists. We are probably going to say some things wrong.
Absolutely. Like, it never go at your podcast co-host, dude. Like, they're way nice people. They're doing a podcast with you. You know what I mean? Like, do not. You're going to say some things wrong.
But always, guys. Before we get into the show, let's go over our sources. And of course, the first stop on the old choo-choo research train is our good friend Wikipedia.
Because we stan Wikipedia on this motherfucking podcast.
And if you find yourself in the situation to do so, go ahead and throw them a couple bucks. I'm sure they could use it.
And you can join your friends at the Back Ass Words podcast in donating to Wikipedia. We donate every time we record.
It's a good fake poltergeist deed.
Ah, very, very nice, Kyle. Although I will say that just based off the context, I think the phrase you were looking for was philanthropic deed.
Ah, we'll get there.
One day.
So I used the Wikipedia page on the Enfield poltergeist. I also used the real story of the Enfield haunting from The Telegraph, the Enfield poltergeist from Horrified Magazine, Inside the Terrified Haunting That Inspired The Conjuring 2 from All That's Interesting, and I used a Tumblr article from the Ouija Girl titled The War and Curse. And we will also be using audio from the Enfield poltergeist real voice recordings from Unsolved Videos.
Ooh, we got some audio tonight, folks.
We do.
Hell yes. I'm so excited. I know nothing about this case. I'm so excited to learn about this. I know it's a big name. I think we're all ready, Kyle. Take us into it.
Now, hold on to your asses, because things are about to get backwards. On the evening of Tuesday, the 30th of August, 1977, Peggy Hodgson, a 47-year-old divorced mother of four, went into her children's room to tell them to stop fighting and to go to sleep.
Stop fighting! Go to sleep!
They were complaining that the bed was shaking, but thinking no more of it, Peggy went to bed.
What? Dude, the bed is shaking, Mom. Mm-hmm. Go to sleep.
Go the fuck to sleep. The next night, Peggy heard a shuffling noise, like someone was walking on a linoleum floor in slippers. And then she heard four loud knocks.
What?
A chest of drawers had slid across the floor. Peggy pushed it back into place, and it just slid forward again immediately.
Whoa.
She tried to push it back into place again, but it wouldn't budge. It was then that the family fled to the Nottingham family's house just down the street and asked for help. Vic Nottingham, a roofer, and his son, Gary, went over to the Hodgson's house to investigate and heard knocks coming from all over the house.
Oh my God.
Thinking that somebody was playing a prank on the family, they called the police, who came out to the house at 1 o'clock in the morning. The police checked the walls, the attic, and even the piping in the house, but they could find nothing to explain the tapping. One of the police officers said, quote,
"The other officer and the neighbors all went into the kitchen to check the refrigerator pipes, etc., leaving the family and myself in the living room. The lights in the living room were switched off again, and within a few minutes, the eldest son pointed to a chair that was standing next to the sofa. I looked at the chair and noticed that it was wobbling slightly from side to side. I then saw the chair slide across the floor toward the kitchen wall. It moved approximately 3 to 4 feet and then came to a rest." Dude!
We're starting off pretty strong out the gate here, aren't we, Arden?
This is absolutely bonkers. If this is the first interaction that they're having with this, whatever the hell it is, this is incredibly unprecedented levels of paranormal activity.
And that's a police officer's testimony, too. And I mean, you know, we feel like police, but like, their testimonies are usually held in higher, to a higher standard and in a higher regard.
Because they truly have no skin in that game, like, at all.
Yeah, and this is one thing about this case that many people immediately point to, is that there were so many goddamn witnesses to this shit, as you'll see as we go through this story. But just based off of those first two nights, how are you feeling, Arden?
I mean, I'm kind of losing my mind. I feel like I just said it with what I just said about, like, this is an unprecedented level of paranormal activity right off the bat. I mean, like, straight away. Unprecedented. This is wild. This is one of the craziest stories I've ever heard.
It only goes up from here.
I can imagine, because if we've learned anything from the Warrens, is that these things happen in stages, right?
They do, yes. So the next night, Vic, the neighbor, went back to the house and was attacked by flying Legos.
We've all been there. Am I right? You step on one.
He wasn't stepping on them, though. They were being flung at him with enough force to leave bruises.
Bruises, huh?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
And marbles and Lego continued to fly around the house for the next 3 days. And people came by and tried to help, including members of the local council and clergymen. No one could do anything. At a loss as what to do, on the 4th of September, Miss Nottingham called the Daily Mirror, hoping that they could do something or at the very least find someone who could help her. The Mirror sent reporter Douglas Bentz and photographer Graham Morris. Graham Morris later said, quote,
I thought it was an ordinary job until I walked into the house. I stood in the gloom in the kitchen, and one by one they brought the children into the adults' arms, and the last one to come in was Janet. Suddenly, things just took off and started flying around the room. I got hit by a Lego brick over my right eye. It gave me a lump for a few days. There was a fair bit of force. There were marbles and things left in the kitchen that were flying around the room. I was watching all of the family, and none of them was doing anything.
Like they're used to it, dude? Like they're like, wow, this has been happening for forever.
Well, that, but also none of them were moving. They weren't like pulling any strings to make shit fly around. They weren't throwing them themselves. They were chilling. Because, yeah, they had at this point kind of stopped reacting to it.
Wow. But it's not like they're in a trance or something, right? Like they're not being like actively like possessed or astral projecting or something.
No.
All right. Perfect. So literally shit starts flying around the house and a bunch of people come over and notice and they're immediately trying to get help.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is absolutely wild.
Yeah. George Fallows, a senior reporter for the Mirror, and photographer David Thorpe then visited the house. So they sent some more experienced people after the first team came through.
Okay.
Fallows at first believed that Peggy, the mother, was playing tricks in order to get a new council house, but soon realized that something serious was going on. Because this was a council house, it's kind of like Section 8 housing, right? It's public housing.
Okay.
And George Fallows was reported as saying, quote,
because of the emotional atmosphere at the house and in the neighborhood, ranging from hysteria through terror to excitement and tension, it has been difficult to record satisfactory data. Nevertheless, I am satisfied the overall impression of our investigation is reasonably accurate. To the best of our ability, we have eliminated the possibility of total trickery, although we have been able to simulate most of the phenomena. In my opinion, this faking could only be done by an expert. So essentially saying that the level of paranormal activity, if someone was faking it, it would be very difficult to fake it this good.
Yeah, they tried to do it. They went through and they found they could kind of make the same tapping sounds happen. They could, you know, rig up ways to make stuff fly around the room, but to be able to do it to the level that they were doing it and in a way that, you know, they weren't able to be seen reacting to it and making it happen means that they absolutely would have required like an expert to come in and help them do this.
Well, and especially because these bouts are so spontaneous, right? Like, how do they make it happen on a dime like that?
Exactly. And because of this, Fallows suggested contacting the Society for Psychical Research, or the SPR.
Okay.
He was put in contact with Maurice Gross, who was a relatively new member of the Society, who had joined after the recent death of his daughter the year before.
Aw.
Gross visited the house on the 5th of September. Speaking of that first visit, he said, quote,
I found chaos. The whole family was congregated in the house together with the neighbors next door, and there were a lot of very, very frightened people there.
So he's walking right into that atmosphere that they were talking about before. This just like all over the place energy.
Yeah. Gross and the members of the press waited to witness any incidents, and on Wednesday, the 8th of September, 3 days later, at 1:15 a.m., they rushed into the children's bedroom after hearing a loud crash.
Okay.
The two sisters, Janet, aged 11, and Margaret, aged 13, were still asleep, but a chair had flipped over and moved 3 feet across the room. This was enough to convince Maurice to stay and investigate further.
Wow. Quick. Mm-hmm. Quick to him arriving there, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, not quite. I mean, 3 days. So it wasn't like immediate, you know.
Not immediate, but I mean, to investigate this.
Yeah.
If it happened to me in 3 days, I think that's what you're about to say, right? Like, that's crazy. Yeah.
On the 10th of September, the Daily Mirror broke the story, describing it as the house of strange happenings. Later that evening, Peggy appeared on a radio program called Nightline on LBC, a London radio station.
Okay.
When Peggy arrived home after recording the show, she was greeted by the BBC's Roz Morris from the Radio 4 show, The World This Weekend.
Wow.
Roz joined Gross on an all-night vigil and also witnessed some paranormal activity. He said, quote,
"After the girls went to bed, there was a very loud crash upstairs in their bedroom. Something chucked the chair across the room. I'm convinced of that."
Gross also saw the flying marbles, jumping teaspoons and boxes, and a sofa that rose into the air and crashed onto the floor upside down.
What?
And Gross was among several people to witness these events. Other witnesses included the reporters and next-door neighbors. Gross and the photographer rigged up a camera that would take photos when triggered and managed to capture Janet being thrown from her bed.
What? What? What?
Some people argued that the photo could just be her jumping on the bed, but...
What?
Yeah, no, let me pull them up for you. Search it right now.
Oh, this one.
Yes. Yeah, you've seen the picture before, for sure. Yeah.
Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. Okay.
Realizing that he was out of his depth, Gross asked the SPR for help in investigating the poltergeist. In response, Guy Playfair accepted the request and arrived at the house on the 12th of September. He later went on to write the book, This House is Haunted, The True Story of the Enfield Poltergeist.
Interesting that it is not Ed and Lorraine Warren following this exact same behavior, huh?
It is interesting, isn't it?
Interesting how a lot of them do stuff like this, right? Yeah.
And they'll come into the story later, don't worry.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. But something that I'm really connecting to here right now, Kyle, is how many people are vouching for this alleged paranormal activity happening in this house in such a small time frame, in a relatively small time frame. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. The number varies, but it goes between like 15 to up to like 30 people who have testified to seeing this shit happen in this house.
And if I'm understanding, if I'm following the timeline that you're laying out correctly, these different people are seeing this different paranormal activity within weeks of each other.
Yeah, let's see. We're on September 12th, and this started on the 30th of August. So, like 2 weeks.
Within days of each other.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
The family was finally chased out of the house on Sunday, the 25th of September, and sought refuge with Peggy's brother, who lived just up the road.
It's just like the Lutz family, dude. They got ran out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
But while his wife, Sylvia, was making some tea, a Lego brick appeared in front of her and dropped on the table. The way she described it, it materialized in the air in front of her and just plopped on the table. Not like it was thrown or tossed or set there. She saw it fall straight down.
I am in complete shock. That is one of the scariest things I've ever heard in any ghost story ever.
Because, like, here, like, the thing is, in a horror movie, that's like, okay, yeah, it's scary.
Yeah,
if for that real. Happened to you in real life, that could be enough to, like, significantly shake, like, the foundations of your psychiatry, your fucking brain, for a bit.
It's shaking the foundations of my psychiatry right now. Like, yeah. I am, this is, that was chills up my spine. Mm-hmm. Oh, so
the family had learned that the entity was able to follow them out of the house.
We're not dealing with a ghost.
No, we're not.
We're dealing with a demon. It's that scene in the movie that you're always talking about, Kyle. We're not fighting for their lives. We're fighting for their souls.
Exactly.
Be gone, Satan.
Gross and Playfair saw indentations in pillows and on the bed as though somebody was lying on it.
I'm literally going to vomit, dude. This is unbelievable. Oh, God.
In the course of the investigations, they came under a hypothesis that the spirit of a 4-year-old child who had been smothered with a pillow by her father might have been responsible for the incidents. See, Peggy had given items of furniture from the house of the little girl when she moved into the property in Enfield. So Peggy made sure to throw out any furniture belonging to the little girl's former house, but the activity continued.
Wow, that is crazy. That I don't know what to say. I'm sorry, take this out, but like, oh my God, like,
yeah,
this is literally, this has got to be the craziest paranormal account I've ever heard of already. Like,
and that's what I'm saying. It's like, there's some crazy shit, there's some obviously fake shit, but there is some weird fucking shit with this story.
And that paragraph that you just read, I mean, that's just so heavy. Like, that's a lot, you know what I mean? And, like,
yeah,
it does remind me a little bit of kind of what we discussed in Annabelle, particularly in the Annabelle movie, where it's, like, sometimes removing the cursed objects or things that, like, spirits are attached to, sometimes that does not necessarily remove the presence from the area or from whoever it's attached to, right?
Right.
Especially if we're dealing with a demon.
A demon. So Janet, the younger sister, was the center of the activity, which is common in poltergeist cases, which predominantly affect girls and young women.
This is true.
Two psychiatrists named Piero Brovetto and Vera Maxia wrote a paper called Some Conjectures About the Mechanism of the Poltergeist Phenomena. And they argued that children generate poltergeist activity by channeling energy into the quantum mechanical vacuum. They manifest it.
Right? That's interesting, because a lot of people do talk about how, like, children are closer to, like, the veil or whatever. Mm-hmm. This is an interesting way to describe that.
Their paper postulates that although poltergeist activity had been reported around the world in almost every single culture, the one thing that they all have in common is prepubescent children or young women. The two psychiatrists believe that during puberty, some modification of the body happens, which involves various organs, and these changes create fluctuations in electron activity that can cause disturbances up to a few meters around the outside of the brain. They believe that the extra fluctuations triggered by the prepubescent brain can enhance virtual particles around the person, which increase the air pressure surrounding them, which could be responsible, for removing, the objects. What do you think?
That's very, very interesting. The audience didn't get to see it, but I was kind of like slow clapping a little bit during that paragraph that Kyle was reading, because that is one of the more interesting ways that I've heard that put.
I would definitely need to see more science on it.
Definitely need to see more science, but it is an interesting hypothesis, especially when you pair it with what we talked about in our Ed and Lorraine section of this six-part series, essentially, where they claimed that during their paranormal research as well, that ghosts, in particular ghosts, need to latch on to energy, right? And so it would be interesting to pair that where they're at right now, where they think this is a poltergeist, right?
Right. But it does, and I wanted to talk about this. We haven't talked about this in our whole series yet, and I'm shocked.
Okay.
It does kind of, I don't know if it contradicts the theory necessarily, but it does misalign with the theory, the Wednesday phenomena theory that we have been building over the course of this show as well.
Interesting.
Right? The idea that whether it's aliens or Sasquatch or poltergeists, most of these things are the same thing, trying to interact with our level of reality and our level of consciousness, right?
Yes.
And again, I don't think it necessarily discredits that, right? Or flies in opposition to that by any means, because I think that can move to explain why there are differences in how these things manifest. You know, sometimes maybe it is a Wednesday phenomena thing, sometimes maybe it's a ghost, and sometimes maybe it's just your brain fucking shit up, you know? Who the fuck knows?
Yeah, and I mean, it is an interesting conversation to bring into the month of October that we're having, because the Wednesday phenomenon is something that we've been talking about on the show for quite some time, right? And it's something that I always think about ever since we talked about it during Mothman, honestly. Mm-hmm. I can't get it out of my head.
Changed my life a little bit. Yeah, I can't think. I think about it all the time.
It's that same experience that a lot of people have when they learn about the simulation theory for the first time, right?
Yeah, honestly.
When I heard about the Wednesday phenomenon, it kind of fundamentally rocked my worldview. And I would actually posit to say that I think that the Wednesday phenomenon still stands strong on its own two feet in the course of our podcast, I would say.
Yeah, I think so too.
The way that I attribute stuff like this, or even like the differences between like the cryptids and the aliens and the ghosts and the whatnot, the way that I attribute that is like these things happen at different points in time. And what does time mean to the entities that are interacting with our consciousness and interacting with our world? Because once again, like if we're talking about the Wednesday phenomenon, like I'll open this up, like I attribute that to a fourth dimensional being, right? There's something beyond our three dimensional world in which the fourth dimensional world can interact with our world. And the fourth dimension, as we all know, is time. And in theory, in a fourth dimensional world, if we accept this as reality for a second, time would be a dimension that one can interact with at any given quote unquote point in time as we understand it, right?
Right.
And so with that, if these things are happening at different points in time and manifesting themselves in different ways, we couldn't even begin to understand that in the first place, right? Especially if we're running with the fourth dimensional idea. And so
yeah,
I don't know,
I'm trying to figure out how to use a laptop, you know?
Yeah, that's a perfect way to describe it. And so I think that stuff like this perfectly aligns with the Wednesday phenomena, because it can be so different all the time, because they're interacting with time as a dimension in a completely different way than we could ever imagine, let alone the way we interact with time as we know it.
Couldn't have said it better myself, honestly.
I'll drink my Coke Zero to that.
I'll drink my Smoke Zero.
Very nice, Kyle. Very nice. Fascinating, dude. This is buck wild.
Mm-hmm.
This is rocking my world right now, dude. I did not expect to get rocked this hard by this story.
The word poltergeist is derived from the German words poltern, which means to crash or bang about, and Geist, which means to mind, ghost, or spirit. And the earliest reports of poltergeist activity date back to AD 530, at least under that name, right?
So poltergeists really are like the Heisenbergs. They're like, I am the one who knocks, you know? That's what their name means. I'm a ghost who knocks.
God damn it.
I had to hit you with a dumb one at some point, dude. They can't all be so absolute eaters all the time, dude.
What do you mean? That was the best joke you've ever told. Oh, that was amazing.
I appreciate it.
A study of 500 cases carried out by parapsychologists Alan Galt and Tony Cornell found that poltergeist activity involved in 64% of cases the movement of small objects, in 48% of cases had rapping sounds, and 36% of cases had the movement of large objects such as tables or chairs. Many of the witnesses to the haunting described hearing hollow knocks that were coming from all different parts of the house. And as we said earlier, they said that they could recreate these knocks, right?
Right.
Sort of.
Okay.
What differentiates a poltergeist knock from a human knock is in the difference of acoustic sound waves. Something you're a little bit familiar with, Arden, having looked at waveforms while editing the podcast, right?
Right.
So when a human knocks on a surface, and I'll even give you one here so you can see it while you're editing. When a human knocks on a surface, there is a full amplitude of sound right up front. The wave is super big, and then it tapers off, right?
Right.
Super big, tapers off.
Right.
A poltergeist knock starts quietly before becoming louder and then fading away in a similar waveform to an earthquake.
Kind of like, can I imagine it like echolocation, where like it goes...
Yeah, like a swamp.
I see, okay.
They rev up a little bit, right?
Okay, I see, okay.
According to Dr. Barry Colvin, who is a polyurethane technologist that carries out experimental psychical research, poltergeist sound signatures cannot be reproduced by natural means.
That is so interesting that they like were able to analyze those waveforms and see that difference, because that is significant, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that does indicate a difference. And so if we can't reproduce those types of waveforms, then when those types of waveforms are present, we're dealing with something signal. Genuine, allegedly.
Yeah. Allegedly.
Allegedly. It's a demon.
The Hodgson house was not a happy one when the activity started, and it is commonly believed that poltergeist activity tends to start after major trauma or major life events or changes.
Fair.
And in the case of the Hodgsons, their father had abandoned them for a younger woman, and the family was left struggling with poverty. Yeah, he straight up just dipped.
Wow.
Yeah.
Damn, that would definitely invite some bad vibes into the area, you know?
The two girls, Margaret and Janet, did not have a very good relationship with their father to begin with, and they were actually have said that they were afraid of him.
That's not good.
Yeah. There was also a younger child in the family named Billy, who was not with the family at the times of the hauntings because of behavioral problems. And was in a boarding school.
Okay, so he wasn't subject to all of this.
Yes.
Okay, interesting. It is interesting that there's like one member of their family who has like nothing to do with this.
Yeah.
Hmm.
William Roll, a parapsychologist who studied a lot of United States poltergeist events, has noticed a tendency for the person at the center of the activity to exhibit symptoms of repressed anger or distress. He believed that the haunting was due to a discharge of mental energy he dubbed recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, or RSPK.
Wow, we love a good acronym, don't we? Always throwing them in there.
Which just means you keep throwing shit around with your mind. That's all it means, direct translation.
Right, and I guess, again, like, it kind of pairs to, like, the energy thing that Ed and Lorraine Warren were talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah. He theorized that the person was involuntarily employing RSPK in order to let out their repressed feelings, like a teapot letting out steam.
Ah, very good. That's a really good way to describe that.
Or, sorry, a tea kettle.
Oh, my God. Kyle, show some respect.
This certainly seemed to be the case with Janet, who had a license to swear profusely and displayed increasingly aggressive behavior during the haunting.
Okay.
She would suddenly rush across the room and bash her head into the wall, and her family became concerned that she would end up killing herself. She would have fits of rage where she would shout and swear, and she would have to be physically restrained. This is an 11-year-old girl.
That is just so aggressive. Like, if something is, like, making her do that, like, that's a very violent apparition or a manifestation.
Mm-hmm. Towards the end of November, a doctor was called to the house, and he administered 10 milligrams of Valium in order to sedate her, which is, like, the maximum daily recommended dosage for a child, from what I could find.
Wow.
After being sedated.
Right.
Janet levitated and landed on a radio where she was discovered by John, Peggy's brother, her uncle.
Whoa. This is wild. It seems to be latching on to her very specifically, right?
Mm-hmm. Which is, as we've stated, very common in most haunting scenarios, specifically poltergeists, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to take a second here to listen to a recording of the supposed possession here.
And is this of Janet being possessed?
Yes. So this recording specifically is Janet saying that she was possessed by a spirit of a man named Bill.
Okay.
I'm 32 years old. I come from Durham Park graveyard. And I have right near the church where Rena lives. And all my friends come from there as well. And we all make a day and go to the pub. And then we picked your house, because I used to live here. And I will tell you the law. And if you don't get anyone else, just send Mr. Hook and Mr. Blayback. So that they can protect me from you killing me, they can guide you right on.
How can we kill you, Bill?
You could shoot me off.
Now how can we shoot you if we can't see you, Bill?
By praying to God.
Sorry, I didn't hear that, Bill.
By praying to God.
By praying to God.
That's an 11-year-old girl.
I gotta say, that sounds very, very real to me.
Yeah, and the thing is, she reportedly would speak like that for, like, hours.
Not very easy to fake, my friends.
No, I mean, you can talk like that for a little bit, but I already feel like I have to cough.
You know,
I already want to quit.
Yeah, and to hold that up for hours?
That's some of the more disturbing fucking footage that I've heard of one of these possession cases. Very bone chilling, dude.
But I will say, it does kind of remind me of Was it Annalise Mikkel that we had the audio of her like speaking in German?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that vocal tone, you know?
That's why I was saying, like, it sounds like a very genuine case of something's going on. I mean, we didn't determine that Annalise Mikkel was possessed, but the fact that their voices are so similar lends a little bit more credence to Janet's story, for sure, in my opinion. Yeah.
But Janet was not the only person affected by the poltergeist. Her mother claimed to know when events were about to take place, as she would get a headache, and she and Margaret at one point shared the same dreams.
That's crazy. And she's also the lady who's like, I can feel it in my bones when it's about to rain, dude.
Mm-hmm. But the activity always specifically followed Janet around. Apparitions started to appear, and a neighbor's brother saw a light about a foot tall burning in the Hodgson's window before fading away.
Damn.
Another neighbor and Peggy saw the same elderly woman in different windows, independently of each other, at the same time.
What? Like an apparition?
Yeah.
What? No.
Janet's brother Johnny saw an old man with big teeth staring at him.
Uh-huh.
In all, it's believed around 15 different people saw some kind of supernatural entity during the haunting. Specifically an entity, not even just saw shit flying around. Specifically, 15 people saw a ghost-like apparition.
This is now very much like what I was saying a couple episodes ago. I forget which episode it was, but this is like a Hopkinsville goblin where you like a story where like you have a mm-hmm. bunch of people saying the same shit about the same place. That is wild. I've never heard of a ghost story having this many witnesses.
Yeah, and you know, none of them have anything to fucking gain from talking about this.
Doesn't seem like it to me.
It's the classic thing we always talk about, whether it's paranormal activity or aliens. People get their lives ruined when they talk about this shit. They don't make money. They don't make a living, you know? There's no reason to come out about this stuff besides telling the truth.
Yeah, they're not Ed and Lorraine Warren, who, may I remind you, are nowhere in this story yet, my friends. This is why this story feels so genuine to me so far, is because, like, for all intents and purposes, it just sounds like super intense paranormal activity that we've talked about, like, in a serious way on the show before.
Yeah. A physicist named John Hasted strapped Janet to an instrument called a Blundell couch, which is an apparatus that is used to measure similar anomalies. And he found that her weight had increased in a way that could not be explained.
Oh my God.
She's super dense.
She's like that girl from One Piece.
Yeah. He also observed a light bulb explode, which he considered a similar unexplainable event.
No power surge, no nothing like that.
Nope. Just
that's unexplainable.
Another physicist named David Robertson attempted to secretly video record Janet, but found it impossible to conceal the equipment. But he did, however, see several unexplainable incidents, such as a sideboard overturning, Janet levitating, and a couch cushion being transported to the roof, among other things.
Just stacking on the amount of people who are seeing shit in this house, like, oh my God.
And a lot of people, like I said, thought that they were faking this kind of stuff to try and get a new house assigned to them, right?
Mm.
And the council did refuse to rehouse the family, but they did send them away for a week-long break. They went to Clacton-on-Sea, and the only incident that happened to occur there was the sound of a dog barking from Janet's bed. So they did get a little vacation there.
But even when they were away from the house, there's this alleged dog apparition, I guess, following them?
Yes.
Mm.
On November the 5th, when the Hodgsons returned from their holiday, Mr. Gross decided to communicate with the spirit using knocks, right? It's a pretty common spiritual communication practice.
Mm-hmm.
One knock means no, and two knocks means yes. He asked some questions.
Are you a male spirit?
Knock, 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 knock.
Did you used to live in this house?
Knock, 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 knock.
Was it more than 50 years ago?
Knock, 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 knock.
Did you die in this house?
Knock, 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 knock.
Are you unhappy?
No, 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 no.
Why are you here? Is it because you want to give us a special message?
No, 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 no.
Are you having a game with me? No response.
They didn't get a response.
No response, folks. That's why. That's a crazy conversation. That is a wild conversation to have with a ghost, dude. Are you unhappy?
I would not be sleeping that night. Holy shit.
One knock. I'm not unhappy. What? Then what are you doing?
Why? What's happening here?
You're happy and you're here, dude? Why are you here? Is it because you want to give us a special message? No. The answer is no? Then why?
And in response to the question, are you having a game with me? The spirit threw a cardboard box and a pillow at Maurice Gross's face.
So he did get a response.
Yeah. So you can interpret that for sure.
Yeah, that's three knocks. That means fuck you.
On Monday, the 10th of November, which was Janet's 12th birthday. Happy birthday, Janet.
Happy birthday.
Mr. Playfair invited an Argentinian psychic named Eduardo Balanovsky to visit. He brought a magnetometer, which they used to look for anomalies in the electromagnetic field around the house.
Right.
During his visit, Janet's pillow was thrown around and the machines registered a change in the electromagnetic field strength.
This kind of connects back to what they were talking to earlier about those signals that you put off from your brain.
Exactly.
All right.
On the 12th of November, Janet, on the advice of the psychic, left pens and paper around the house and called out to the entity to leave her a message.
Whoa.
Never a good idea.
They want Annabelle notes to show up.
Yeah.
Crazy.
And after this, messages started appearing around the house.
No! This is way too wild. Dude, how is this a story? How have I not heard about this before? This is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Literally everything that you could want it to do. It's like every step of the process, they're like, please give us this. Please give us this. And the Enfield poltergeist is like, here you go, on a silver platter.
And the Warrens, again, are not here yet.
Oh my God.
And Peggy found one of these notes on the fridge that said,
I will stay in this house. Do not read this to anyone or I will retaliate.
A fucking threat, dude. A threat.
The next message, which was found on the living room table, said,
can I have a tea bag?
What is this, a 2003 Call of Duty lobby? Like, what's going on?
Well, Peggy placed a tea bag onto the table, and a ripped open tea bag manifested next to it.
So the demon's just like flexing a little bit. It's like, check this out.
Basically.
Damn.
Peggy's ex-husband, the father who abandoned them, turned up at the house and she showed him the messages.
No!
Once he had gone, Peggy apologized to the entity for showing him the messages and another one appeared, saying,
It was a misunderstanding. Don't do it again. And I know who that was.
Kay?
It is worth noting that it was observed that the writing was very similar to Janet's.
Well, that would make sense since the entity is connected to Janet in such direct way.
Yeah. On Tuesday, the 29th of November, the first medium appeared at the house. A Brazilian psychic called Luiz Gasparetto visited the family.
All right, Luiz, strolling up to the scene.
Yeah, and he was accompanied by his interpreter, Elise Dubgrasa, who was a member of the healing department of the Sao Paulo State Spiritist Federation.
Okay.
They offered some spiritual healing to the family, which did give some respite. Luiz would go into a trance-like state and produce drawings and paintings. And after they left, Janet began producing disturbing, bloody pictures while she was in a trance. She also wrote the name Watson over and over and over on a page.
Just a whole page filled with Watsons.
Multiple books of pages full of Watsons. And it turns out that a family named the Watsons had lived in the house, and the wife had died of a tumor in her throat in a similar way to a picture, one of the bloody pictures that Janet had drawn.
Okay. 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 Yeah. Absolutely. You know what? Back assward stance right now. This is real. I'm sorry. Like,
it's fucking weird, dude.
I don't know what to say, dude. Like, this story is flooring me every other sentence. It's one of those stories to me.
Yeah. On Saturday, the 3rd of December, Janet was pulled out of her bed, and Maurice found her sliding down the stairs head first while she was asleep.
Oh, God. I mean, again, it's just so violent, just so acting, just so has a fucking problem with Janet, dude. And I don't know.
And we're just over 2 months into this manifestation now, right?
Oh, my word.
A couple of days later, another member of the SPR joined the team, a student physicist named David Roberts. More members of the SPR team joined them on the 10th of December. One Dr. John Beloff and Anita Gregory. This whole group challenged the entity to speak, and after some whistles and barking, a gruff voice calling himself Joe Watson began to speak.
Watson! There it is!
However, the next night, the voice said that his name was Bill Wilkins. And on Tuesday, the 13th of December, Maurice Gross's son, Richard, who was a newly qualified solicitor, helped his father interrogate the presence.
So we got switching entities, and they're like, we're going to figure out what this means right now.
Mm-hmm. The spirit responded with banging in response to the questions, but a man's voice was soon heard coming from somewhere behind Janet's neck. Was not coming from her mouth.
It's coming from behind her specifically.
Yes.
Oh my God, dude. It's like the fucking demon in Insidious that just pops up behind Patrick Wilson, dude.
Yeah. And these are the recordings that we listened to earlier.
These are the same recordings.
Yes.
I see. Okay. Okay.
The voice identified itself as Bill Wilkins, who had died in the house at the age of 72. Richard asked him how he died, and he said, I went blind, I had a hemorrhage, I fell asleep, and I died in a chair in the corner downstairs. Bill's son, Terry, later confirmed that this was indeed how his father had died.
Wow.
How would he have known? How would she have known that?
How would any of them have known
how
that?
Would That's exactly any of them what have I was going to say.
Yeah, no, there's no way. Like, enough said, honestly. Like, how would they have known?
To rule out the possibility of Janet faking the voice, Gross taped her mouth over, but the voice continued.
No. Dude, they did such a good job. They did such a good job with this shit, dude.
They even went as far as having Janet hold water in her mouth, which she did, and the voice could still be heard talking.
I like that they made her do that cool trick that ventriloquists will do, you know?
Yeah. But she's 12.
I know, that's crazy. No, but like for real, again, like they're doing a really good job like verifying this.
Yeah. Gross recorded hours of this voice speaking using a contact microphone placed on the back of Janet's head. A speech therapist who examined Janet said that they could not be certain where the voice was coming from, though it did bear some resemblance to a false vocal cord tone, like what a ventriloquist would use.
So they're saying that the possibility of her doing it isn't completely ruled out?
Not 100%.
Right.
Still maybe weird and still hard, but like technically, physically possible.
Yeah, like we're chilling at a 95% instead of 100%.
There's a voice effect known as fleca ventricularis, which is where muscle tension behind the throat can produce sounds independent of the vocal cords. However, using this muscle tension to speak often results in an extremely sore throat and can do some serious damage, none of which happened to Janet, who would speak like this for up to 3 hours.
Right.
Since no cause could be found, it was concluded that something was using Janet as an amplifier.
And again, if we're going back to the Wednesday phenomena, this would be a fourth dimensional being using a third dimensional entity, i.e. a human, i.e. Janet, to communicate.
Yeah, exactly. Like when we put little nanobots in ants and make them walk around and shit, you know?
Mm-hmm. Just like that.
Gross and Playfair decided to hypnotize Janet and called in Dr. Ian Fletcher, who was a hypnotist, surgeon, and a member of the Magic Circle. Fletcher put Janet into a light state of hypnosis and asked her some questions. Do you know who is doing all of this?
Me and my sister.
Why do you think you are to blame?
I don't know who is.
What does it feel like?
Cold hands gripping me around my body.
Who started this trouble?
None of us.
What is the cause of the trouble?
An increase in unhappiness.
Fletcher later said, quote,
the impression I formed was this was not fraud. She said her and her sister are doing some of these things, maybe springing out of bed. Something is forcing them to do it against their will.
I will say that I find it interesting that in this communication, the entity said that there is an increase in unhappiness, but previously when they communicated via Nox, the entity said that they weren't unhappy. You know what I mean?
Well, no, an increase in unhappiness caused him to be there, but he himself is not unhappy.
Ah, I see. So an increase in unhappiness, perhaps connecting back to the energy of their father leaving them, right?
Exactly.
I see. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah. On Friday, the 23rd of December, the family goldfish died, and Bill admitted that he had electrocuted them in the tank using spirit energy.
Okay, why am I feeling like that this is the most asshole thing that this entity did?
Right?
In spite of everything else, why is this like the most cruel and unusual thing that it did?
Well, on Christmas Day, the pet parakeet was found dead in its cage.
Bro, stop! What the fuck?
And later that day, Janet was found with a curtain wrapped around her neck.
Okay, all right. Fuck this. Enough of this, dude. This is so fucking stressful. I can't stop myself from saying the F word. That's how stressed I am right now.
Yeah.
The animals are dying. She's getting a noose around her neck. Oh my God.
Janet later complained that a knife was following her around upstairs, and Peggy found one of the knives that she had just put away on the stairs.
How does the Enfield Poltergeist hit every single fucking bullet point that a ghost story can? There's it's stuff crazy. Levitating, furniture's moving around, people are levitating, it's communicating through the human and also not through the human. Like, it's everything all in one story.
Speaking later in her life, Janet said, quote,
"I was used and abused. There was levitation, there was the voices, and then there was the curtain that wrapped itself around my neck, which was quite life-threatening for me. And it brought it home to me that this could kill you."
Can't say I blame her for that one. That, I mean, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If there was ever anything that a ghost could do to make me feel like I was going to die, it would be to tie a fucking curtain around my neck, you know?
Yeah. On the Sunday, the 15th of January, which was Peggy's birthday.
Happy birthday, writing, Peggy.
Happy birthday, Peggy. Writing in fecal matter appeared on the wall. This was followed a few days later by puddles of diarrhea, which were sent into testing at a lab and came back as cat urine.
Interesting. Okay.
Peggy also saw a man from the waist down walking up her stairs. And a few days later, "I am Fred" was found written on the bathroom door with electrical tape.
The only other place that you can find "I am Fred" is in the very early days of YouTube.
God damn it. On May the 16th, we're now in the next year. Mm-hmm. May the 16th, the SPR formed a committee in order to carry out their own investigation.
Finally.
The committee interviewed the witnesses, which they found convincing. They also consulted Charles Moses, an experienced investigator from the Southern California Society for Psychical Research. The committee found that there was good evidence for paranormal phenomena as described by the various witnesses. However, they were reluctant to give credibility to the voice of Bill Watkins.
Specifically the voice of Bill Watkins, but not the other entity?
I think they just mean the vocal stuff in general.
So they're not buying into that, but they buy into pretty much everything else?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay.
On the 25th of July, the family sent Janet to the Maudsley Hospital, which is a psychiatric hospital in South London. And the incidents did die down, even though the family still saw apparitions while she was gone.
Okay.
Janet underwent extensive physical and psychological assessment at the Institute of Neuropsychiatry under Dr. Peter Fenwick, and nothing was found to be wrong with her, including searching for brain damage or epilepsy. Janet returned on the 1st of September after being away for nearly 6 weeks. And within half an hour, she saw the apparition of a little boy.
There is no rest for poor, poor Janet, dude. I feel so bad for her.
And then, very randomly, one night in 1978, Ed and Lorraine Warren showed up at the home.
And this is where the fun begins, folks.
We've been talking for, what, over an hour at this point. I don't know how long the recording's going to end up being, or the episode's going to end up being. And they're finally getting their grubby little hands in here.
Wow. Incredible stuff that we're seeing from the Warrens.
They had not been invited.
Of course not.
But they still asked for an interview from Janet and to check out the home.
They just fucking waltz in here, dude. Just all high and mighty fucking Nesper on their business cards. Just like, hello.
Here's a painting of your house. I know it's a council flat, so you can't put any holes in the wall to hang it up, but here's a painting.
But I would love to sell it to you for $3 to $5, which is like $35 now.
Mr. Playfair says that the Warrens were there for less than a day, and that at one point, Ed pulled him aside to explain that he could make a lot of money off of the haunting.
Dude, they already published a book. Somebody already beat you to it, Ed. Mm-hmm. You gotta... That's probably why they didn't stick around that long.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
And Mr. Playfair quickly dismissed this notion from him.
Yeah.
Janet later on would say that she had no memory of ever even meeting the Warrens.
Oh, but we're out here to help. We changed Nesper's mission statement. We're here to help everybody.
Now, are you ready for another just absolutely insane paragraph, Arden?
I will hold my tongue. Yes, I'm ready.
On Monday, the 2nd of October, they called in another medium, a Dutchman named Dano Gmelig Meling, who came to the house and traveled along the astral plane. He was certain that a 24-year-old woman was involved in this case.
Specifically.
Yes. Now, do you remember at the beginning of the episode when I told you that Maurice Gross's daughter had passed away?
Uh-huh.
Well, Maurice Gross had a daughter named Janet who had died in a car crash at the age of 24, leading him to become a member of the Society for Psychological Research. And after Dono identified the 24-year-old woman, the incidents tapered off and stopped.
What?
Yeah.
Okay, so hold on. So let me see if I have this straight in my brain, yeah. Professor Kyle. So guy knows Maurice Gross's daughter, Janet?
No.
No.
He didn't.
He just had a premonition that a 24-year-old was involved in this case.
Yes.
Okay. And Maurice Gross had a daughter whose name is Janet, who has the same name as the 11-year-old Janet?
Yes.
And she died in a car crash at age 24.
A year before the haunting started.
A year before the haunting started. Okay. And
which
then,
caused him to join the SPR.
Right.
Once she was identified, everything slowed down and stopped.
Once she was identified, like just meaning like it was spoken into existence.
Once they connected these dots, yeah.
Mm. And then the paranormal activity stops.
Yeah, almost like Janet just wanted to say goodbye to her dad, you know?
What a interesting bow to tie on the story.
Mm-hmm. Maurice Gross remained in contact with the family until his death at the age of 87 in 2006. He spent much of his time towards the end of his life defending his investigation of the haunting. Guy Playfair, at the time of writing, remains an active author, researcher, and member of the SPR Council. Peggy Hodgson remained in the house until her death in 2003. Janet left the home at 16 and married early. Her brother John died in 1981 at the age of 14. Both Janet and Margaret have made several television appearances in the subsequent years when they continued to insist on the authenticity of their experiences. In fact, in a 2011 newspaper article, Janet said, quote,
"Years later, when Mum was alive, there was always a presence there, something watching over you."
So they feel it on the flip side, too.
Yeah. And despite only being there for less than a day, Ed and Lorraine Warren decided that they felt justified in adding this case into their official case files.
That's stating crazy.
That, yeah. Their official stance was that Janet was clearly demonically possessed. The Warrens were some of the least educated people about this haunting. And yet, when the Hollywood movie came out about it, they were main characters.
Mm.
Even singing a goddamn song in the middle of the movie for some reason, because we have to make the Warrens look good.
Right.
Thanks to The Conjuring 2, the Warrens are synonymous with the Edenfield Poltergeist, even though they had absolutely nothing to do with it.
Wow.
And that, my little flying Lego pieces, is the Edenfield Poltergeist.
Wow. Kyle, can I just say, very quickly, fantastic work on this outline, my friend.
Thank you. I have to give tons and tons of credit on that. to the Horrified magazine article, the Enfield Poltergeist. Definitely check it out. Phenomenal article.
Yeah, definitely go check that out because, man, this story has got to be, I said it the whole episode, this has got to be one of the wildest stories I've ever heard in my entire life. This yeah. is truly such a compelling story, unlike anything I've ever heard before. And I'm so glad that we talked about it. And I'm so glad that the Warrens have nothing to do with it because I can actually be excited about this one.
Mm-hmm. And with that being said, Arden, let's get into it. How do you feel about this haunting? What do you think happened here? Do you think the girls were faking it? Do you think the mom was faking it to get a new house? What was going on here, man?
I'm going to go ahead and say it, dude. I'm going to say it right now.
This was a haunted-ass fucking house?
This was a haunted-ass fucking house.
Yeah, dude.
This is, by far, one of the most credible haunted house stories I've ever heard in my entire life. I said it earlier. This hits every single fucking bullet point. And I even buy the voice, dude. I hear that recording.
Chills, immediate chills down my spine.
There's no way she's faking that. There is no way.
Not for 3 hours at a time, multiple days in a row. Abso-fucking-lutely not.
Absolutely not. So I am 100% signed, sealed, delivered, putting my stamp of approval on this. I believe that the Enfield Poltergeist happened exactly the way that these people say that it happened, especially yeah. when you back it up with all of the work that they did. Like, they literally covered her mouth with tape. They had her do the ventriloquist trick where she has water in her mouth. The voice is still happening. This is a haunted house.
Yeah, absolutely. The fucking Lego materializing out of thin air, dude.
Dude, you said it, I don't know if we got this on air. I think we might have gotten it in the earlier recording, but me and Kyle were talking before we started actually recording the episode for the show. And I said, how scared am I going to get by this? And he said, I don't think you'll get scared, which is like on a scale of 1 to 10, scared is a 6. Dude, when you told me that that Lego materialized in front of her face, that's a 10. I'm shitting my pants. Yeah. That was one of the worst parts.
Terrifying, dude. Because again, that would break my brain if that happened to me in real life.
Like, absolutely.
And but I'm right there with you, Arden. I think this shit is weird. And the girls even admit to faking some of the shit. Like, they're like, yeah, we were jumping on the beds. Like,
right.
You know, obviously those pictures are fucking fake. But like, right. There's so much other shit with this.
There's an overwhelming amount of paranormal activity that they allege happened here at this house. Yeah,
over the course of 18 months, too.
And then once again, you add on the fact that so many people, very much like a Hopkinsville goblin story, saw all of these entities, saw all of these marbles and Legos flying across. People are getting bruises from the shit that's getting thrown around in this house. Like, I don't know how you have this many people say all of this stuff and none of them are being truthful or accurate. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no way.
No way in hell, man.
Nope. You can't get this many people to all say the same thing. There's no way. No.
So quick back assward stance then. We're 2 for 2 on this one. Some weird shit was happening in that fucking house.
Absolutely. And in regards to our Ed and Lorraine series, they can't claim this at all. They should take it off of their list, dude.
Absolutely. That was what I was going to say next. While this case is very suspicious and I think one of the better examples of paranormal activity in the world, the Warrens do not get the point by any means. They are still 0 and 3.
They're batting 0. And just to kind of roll off of this for a second, we kind of mentioned this in our Ed and Lorraine series where they did touch this case. They did show up here, right? They quote unquote investigated it, right?
Like, but they dipped their pinky toe nail into it. Yeah.
At best. Yeah. But this is kind of what we were talking about when we were talking about how many cases that they've allegedly researched. They were bound to touch something in some way that was genuine paranormal activity. With how
in 10,000 cases? Yeah.
And with how many years they were doing this, statistically, they were bound to hit at least one genuine paranormal account. And maybe this is the only one that they hit. I guess we'll find out next week, huh?
We just might.
And next week is a heater. It's a heater, folks.
Yeah, it is. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast, everybody.
Thank you so very much. We are nearing the completion of our Ed and Lorraine 6-part series, and I am just so happy to be doing this. This has been one of the most fun chapters of this show for me personally.
Same.
I've
been having a ball.
Every single episode has been so great, and we get to do it because of you folks listening. It means the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You can subscribe and review if you are enjoying the show, and if you think someone else will enjoy the show, please share it with them.
Because word of mouth is the best way to spread that. Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, the Warrens are still batting zero. And you know that the Back Asswards podcast is the only place that can give you a certified stamp of approval of a batting average for the Warrens, which is zero at the current moment.
You can listen to our previous episodes for more. I would recommend our episode on the Illuminati.
Yes, the Illuminati, and specifically as it pertains to the election of 1800, which is another fascinating chapter in the Illuminati saga.
Mm-hmm.
I highly recommend giving that episode a listen. Kyle did an incredible job, as they always do.
You can follow me and Arden on Twitter. I am at BackAssWordKyle. Arden is at Arden_Smith. You can follow the podcast on all of your favorite social medias. On Twitter, at BackAssWordsPod. Instagram, BackAssWordsPod. TikTok, Backass Pod, and on Facebook, just search the Backass Words Podcast. I'm Kyle.
I'm Arden.
And we will see you next week. Unless you really need to get out of your apartment, and so you start telling your landlord that it's super haunted, and you try to convince him by, like, taping Legos to the wall and shit.
And as you're taping those Legos to the wall, just make sure that you go into your Audacity program and you edit the sound waves of the knocks that you're creating so that when you play it through your audio recording player, it sounds more like ghosts so that you can stay safe.
And when you're trying to fool your landlord into thinking your apartment's haunted, make sure to make the blood drip from the walls so that you can stay weird.
The danger is real, my friends. I swear to God, I just saw Kyle's closet door move right behind him as we were doing the outro. And wait, I am really? Now shitting my pants. The danger is real, my friends. Stay safe.
We'll maybe see you next week. Wait, did it really move? Yeah, it did. Oh, no. God.
Yes.